I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to The Connection. Tim Merrill has been a pastor and youth leadership mentor in Camden for many decades, with an intimate knowledge of the rhythms and residents of the city. He's now a novelist and dedicated his new book, The Song Sparrow, to the young people of Camden who gave him, quote, the honor of connection. The book weaves together the intersecting lives of priests and politicians and young protesters living under an oppressive surveillance system. Tim Merrill was born in Camden, where he says the Black church has had the greatest influence on him. The music, the prayers, the shouts, the Sunday supper conversations are the soundtrack to his life. He's also wrestled with his faith and is concerned the church has lost its way, choosing conformity over courage. He joins us on The Connection today to talk about the power of redemption and faith and hope and resilience and resistance. I should add that Tim was a guest on and a regular caller to Radio Times, my previous show. In fact, he organized a memorable interview with several young Camden youth who talked frankly about their lives. And Tim Merrill, it's a great pleasure to have you here with us in our Philadelphia studios. Welcome to The Connection.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Marty.
Thank you very much. Before we get to the characters in your book and even the young people that you work with, I want to find out about you. You were born in Camden. What was the Camden of your youth? What was it like to be a young kid there?
I was born in an ideal situation, nuclear family, mom and dad, as they say, born on Saturday in church on Sunday. And it was the Black Evangelical Church, and we were protected there. We felt that we could walk with no danger. We felt that people were always pushing us upward and onward. And it was a beautiful Camden in my day. And it was a city of family and friends, and a city that neighbors looked out for each other.
You also played football, not to take a divergence here, but you're a big guy.
Hey, I wasn't any good, but...
But you played.
I played on a team.
What did you play? What position?
I played on the offensive line, mostly center and guard.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And mostly bench. Yes.
So what has kept you... I mean, it's a big world out there. You could live in many different parts of the world. What has kept you in Camden?
Camden is a place where... there's a compelling spirit. You encounter people that take you places that will not let you go. In my case, a young kid we took to camp. And when we brought him back from camp, I was trying to get somebody to come to the door. And it seemed that nobody was home. So I looked through an open window. And what I saw there hurt my heart. It was trash strewn. There were problems with substance abuse, alcoholism. The utilities clearly were turned off. Dishes piled in the sink. The mixture of the smell of rotting paint and plaster and feces and urine and liquor all there at once. And here this kid has to go in his home. And I say, when I look through that window, every Bible lesson, every song I heard in the church, every piece of scripture finally made sense. And I think, I was 16 years old on a football team, but I went in the back and said, well, let me see if anybody's in the back. And I went in the back and I cried. And that was it for me. From that point on, my life, I didn't know it, and I did not intellectualize or articulate it at that time. But from that point on, my life was dedicated to those kids.
And he was 16 years old, and you've mentored and been in relationship with so many young people in Camden. And I think, sort of broadly speaking, we have all these stereotypes about young people, especially young people of color. And for you, I mean, your work is to tell us that there is so much more to these young people than we know.
You know, every week I talk to a middle-aged man now that I've known since he was a kid. And he ran a very successful street-level enterprise, pharmaceutical enterprise.
I think I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
And we're unpacking his life. And he asked me, he said, so how do people view me? I said, they view you as a monster. Huh. But this is a young man who is brilliant, who did not, and people need to understand that these young people who are placed in this swirl of concentrated poverty, of environmental degradation, of political malfeasance and dysfunction, and all of the worst things that are downloaded and concentrated into these neighborhoods. They don't wake up one morning and say, I want to be a drug kingpin. It is an evolution. And when you get down to who they are, if you have some belief in the human spirit, I found out this young man said he was in a foreign country, and something that I said to him when he was 16 years old clicked.
What was it? What did you say?
We were talking about the accomplishment of black people throughout history. And I said, if you look at much of the world, if you look at Egypt and Africa and things like that, black people were running things. And he said, well, what happened? I said, well, many things happened. But one of the things that we need to address is our being able to work together in unity. And he was in Brazil, and he saw the blackness of Brazil, and it clicked. And since that time, he's read 1,000 books.
Wow.
He is a scholar. He is a scholar who does not have degrees, but I would match him against anybody when it comes to the history of black people, especially within a diaspora. And so, and at his heart, a humane individual who just was born in the wrong zip code, and the evolution took him to places where he never had planned to go. And then you wake up and you're in your mid-20s, and all this is surrounding you, and it comes at such a high cost.
But, I mean, you live here, so you know these people, so you're willing to listen to them, I guess.
We have to listen to them, because one of the things that we've done through many things, from John DiIulio's Coming Age of Super Predator.
Oh, that goes way back.
But it does.
But it was very influential.
It was, and it stripped us of the idea of the humanity of these young people, and that they're just craven, and they have no morals. And I've learned that there's a high level of ethics and morals even among the ones that we call thugs and gangsters, who I often found are more trustworthy than the police.
Wow.
The New Jersey State Police had set me up to be murdered. And yes,
you mean that?
I mean that. There was a drug bust. I was watching from my office window, and one of the kids that was home from school visiting was coming down on the street corner where they had a drug set. And you don't go to the street is respect. And you don't pass these guys without saying, dabbing them up and say, hey, what's up, what's up? As he was doing that, the state police came, and they had him on the ground with everyone else. And I came out to protest on his behalf, and I was met with belligerent and profane language. I had to identify myself. When I really want to get through, I say, I'm Reverend Timothy L. Merle.
L for Luther.
That's right. And so I a few days later, I was doing some work at the church, and a young man from the drug set came by, and I saw him. He did a double take, and I saw him start to reach for the back of his pants where he had a gun. And if it weren't for another kid that came by and greeted me, I would have been shot. And so I went to the guy that was running the drug set. I said, what's going on? One of your guys just tried to take me out. And he told me this. He said, well, I know we have beefs with you, because the state boys told us that they wouldn't even bother us if that pastor would stop calling them about us.
And you're the pastor.
And I'm the pastor. That's a setup to have me killed. And so I actually have learned that there is a higher code among many that we call monsters than we find in many that we call official.
I quoted you in my intro talking about being taught about the power of connection. This is a show called The Connection. So, of course, I jumped on that. But the importance of connection in all of our lives.
We have to listen to people. I don't care if they're... I listen to MAGA folk. I listen to liberal, conservative, everybody. We have to listen to people and keep in mind that we are all human and that we are all subject to impulses. We are all subject to conditional responses. We are all subject to the dictates of our environments, but we are all human. And so my job is to connect through listening so that I may earn the right to speak, and then to do my best to guide our people into the best of their humanity. I can't do that if we're not connected, and I have not earned that right.
Well, I love the way you put that, earning the right to speak. Listening is earning the right to speak.
Exactly, exactly.
We don't often do that, right?
Well, unfortunately, and it's so much easier to judge. It's so much easier to fold in the stereotypes. It's so much easier to hide behind those things so that we will not have the unction to actually listen to people. And I found that's probably my most valuable tool in navigating through Camden is listening.
You write in the acknowledgments to this book that, and you name a number of the churches that have, quote, carried you and tested you through the seasons of your life. And I'm interested in the tested part. We'll talk about the carried part. But did you lose your faith at some point in your life? Your faith in either God or the church?
Marty, I was a Baptist pastor and an atheist at the same time.
How do you do that?
There's a song.
Argue with yourself?
Oh,
right?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And there's a song that says, I kept holding on, but not even knowing why. Yeah. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. And I remember standing in my backyard looking up at the sky and having this conversation with, I wasn't believing in God, so I don't know who I was talking to. I'm a smart guy. I can explain you away, brain chemistry and science and things like that. And I said, you know, show me one thing that I can't explain. That I can't explain. Right. And it was as if God was standing, you know, on the other side of the yard and said, well, explain what's going on with you when you encounter these young people, when you encounter people who are addicted to crack, when you encounter homeless people, the people that are at the bottom rungs. Explain that. And I couldn't. And that began a restoration of my faith. Very different faith. I started reading scripture very differently, and I have a very challenging relationship with the Bible. but a more informed relationship with the Bible. And it's been a freeing episode in my life, regaining faith. And now it's my faith. It's not a faith that was put on me by my parents and by my church. It was a faith that I walked into with eyes wide open.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Tim Merrill is our guest on The Connection today, and he is a pastor in Camden across the river here from Philadelphia. He works a lot. In fact, has dedicated his life to working with young people in Camden and wrote a book. It's a novel, and it's titled The Song Sparrow, A Novel of the Black Church. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Tim Merrill is our guest. Again, he's got a new book called The Song Sparrow, A Novel of the Black Church. And we've been talking about some of the work that he has been doing in Camden. I'm curious about, and I referenced this in my introduction, but I thought like the sounds, the tastes, the smells of the Black Church for you, and I think for a lot of us, those childhood experiences that get embedded in our senses are so powerful. Is there a song that just has rung through your life that connects you to the Black Church?
Well, yes. My mother sang in the choir, and around the house, she always sang. She had an operatic voice and nice. An amazing woman of many talents. And the song that resonates with me is, and I have this picture in my mind, is her dusting the blinds and singing, "He, the pearly gates will open so that I may enter in, for he purchased my redemption and forgave me all my sins." And that takes me straight home.
Wonderful. Oh, I mean, yes. I can almost see her doing the blinds.
So we had church in home and at the tabernacle. We were in church a lot
growing up. You, again, quoting from you, the gospel of community connection and common cause has too often been traded for a gospel of personal success and private blessing. I mean, you have some arguments with your church about a focus on maybe prosperity over preaching.
The church has, I feel, my critique of the Black church is in many respects, it's lost its way.
Truly.
And the whole pursuit of the American dream. And I think it was Gil Scott-Heron, in his version of Inner City Blues said, are we stupid or just naive to believe that money can buy us anything, including a slice of the American dream? Mm. And I think the church has fallen into that. We are sacrificing the spirit of our struggle, you know, as we go in. And it's very much resonant in our music now, the newer music. And I heard one of the top producers of the new Christian, Black Christian music said, well, you know, my parents were doctors. I don't know about struggle. So, but this is the music that is, that resonates with us as people of historic struggle. And the whole lust for prosperity, the lust, you know, everybody now has to have some type of elevated title, you know, and the degrees and things like that. And it's, and I don't despise learning at all, but that is all pretty much useless if it's not employed by the uplifting the people. And if it's not directed toward liberation of all people, and specifically in this case, of Black people. So I want us to get back to that music and that preaching that put us out there on the front lines, that was the drumbeat to the Montgomery bus boycott that we're celebrating the anniversary of, that went with us into the Birmingham jail, that went with us on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we need to recapture that spirit. And it's not completely gone. And there are those that are still proclaiming, but this needs to be the general dynamic of the Black church, especially in these times.
Well, you're talking about those seminal events in civil rights history, but I'm thinking about today. I mean, the literal whitewashing of American history as we get ready to prepare for the 250th anniversary. You know, the erasing of Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, and others, putting back statues of Confederate generals and soldiers. I mean, if that isn't worth fighting for, I don't know what is.
Well, hopefully this is our wake-up call. You know, right down the street, they're trying to erase the history of enslavement among George Washington's household. And if the Black church does not stand up and become the primary educator of our people and our history, then we have failed. And that's one of the things we must undertake, and we must do it right now.
How?
Well, it starts, you know, in the book, for instance, we do some of the history of the foundation of the Black church. We have to proclaim this in our writing. We have to proclaim this in our sermons. We have to have teach-ins like what we used to do. We need to have less seminars and gatherings and convocations on, you know, how to be more prosperous and things like that, and have it on who we are and what God's relationship has been with us historically, how that relationship has brought us through the worst of days, and how that relationship should propel us to the best of days. This needs to be the core of the Black church if it seeks to remain a symbol of hope.
Do you think the church has been co-opted or has lost its courage? Too timid?
You know, Marty, much of this book, one of the underlying themes is the value of sacred Black space.
Yeah.
And our music represents, you know, that sacred Black space, and our churches should represent that sacred Black space. And I think some of our churches, and too many of our churches, have resigned themselves to the corners of sacred white space, where they are sanctioned if they say the wrong thing or if they move the wrong way. And they are also lured in by the promises of material success and blessings and things like that. We as a people need to reclaim that sacred Black space and learn how to not just live in it, but to be dedicated to it, to promote it, and to raise our children to know the value of that space.
What made you want to write this book, and specifically a novel, which I think is one of the hardest things to write, fiction?
You know, I was going to write a theological tome.
I could sort of see it buried in here a little bit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You caught that, right?
I did.
But the power of story, and especially today, the power of story. And the thing that really inspired me to write this was the unheard voices in neighborhoods in Camden. And I look at a lot of our people there, and I realize they will never hear your voice. Huh. And someone needs to proclaim it. Someone needs to proclaim it. And that was the real inspiration for this. I always tell our young people, I said, look, you need to tell your story, because if you don't tell your story, someone else is going to tell it, and they're not going to get it right. And so I'm like, well, Tim, you need to do the same thing. Right. Tell your story as it relates to their story. And the mingling of those two hopefully will provide some hope and some power somewhere.
And again, that's Tim Merrill, our guest today on The Connection. The book he's talking about, The Song Sparrow, a novel of the Black Church. And he is a pastor in Camden, and he works with young people there, has worked with young people for many, many years. You quote Cornel West, and I'll just sort of bastardize a little bit what he said, but the major enemy of Black survival in America, he writes, is neither oppression nor exploitation, but rather the nihilistic threat, the loss of hope and absence of meaning. I mean, without hope and without meaning, I mean, life is hardly worth living.
And that's what we need to be concentrating on, making sure that people in places like Camden do not lose hope. And since I, as you said, I've been in Camden working with in neighborhoods for decades, and I'm so full of hope.
Still.
Oh, my goodness. I've seen young people who have grown up in the worst of conditions, and there's no way you expect them to survive and move on. And you see them now, and their kids are going to college. And I do their weddings and their anniversary celebrations. I attend, and I see these milestones in their life. You know, and I could tell you stories that you would never expect for them to go anywhere. But you know, they're a phlebologist now, or a nurse's aide, and they want to get their next level of schooling so they could be an RN, an LPN. I've seen it. It's incredible to see what the human spirit can do when they have just a little bit of hope.
Well, I wanted to ask you, so what is that little bit of hope, or that's a germ of a sense of the future? Where does that come from?
There has to be someone in their lives to do three things: to express to them love, to express to them affirmation, and express to them encouragement. Hmm. That's been my ministry all these years.
Right.
I watched my father raise my sisters. And what he did with them is he always made a big fuss over them. And so that's what I do. I go to community, and I see our young women, and I make a big fuss over them. Oh, you're such a wonderful child. Oh, you know, I see destiny in your eyes. And our young men, oh, my goodness, you're born in greatness. We need armies to go in, and I'm so heartbroken that through the years we have not had armies of people to go into these neighborhoods and insist on something better and to give that love, that affirmation, that encouragement. That is the key to helping people just hold on. You know, they call me Mr. Tim in most of the neighborhoods. They say, Mr. Tim believes in me. So maybe I'm not what they tell me I am. Maybe there's a chance. Maybe I can rise above. And it's been a wonderful blessing. I'm in the stage now where I'm just glowing. I'm still too many tragedies. Still
of course,
too many. You know,
of course.
I did a funeral a few weeks ago of a young man who grew up with my kids, and he was murdered by his own brother. It's still too many tragedies. But the blessing of seeing people just strive and move upwards. And this is a national story that we don't talk enough about.
And why do you think that is? Because I would say, so broadly speaking, people think of Camden. People that don't live in Camden think of Camden and say, it's a dangerous place. I don't belong there. I'm not going to go there.
Well, We become too comfortable with narratives of destruction and despair. And I think a lot of it fits into our lust for comfort that, you know, I don't engage because what would my engagement do? This is a lost cause. Mm-hmm. I concentrate on narratives of desire and to look at communities, look at people and say, okay, I'm not doing this program to keep you off the streets or to keep you from killing. So I'm doing it because it's good. It's good for your soul. It feeds your soul, it feeds your spirit. And we need to start moving away from this narrative of destruction and dysfunction and start moving to narratives of desire.
Well, I would love to have you read a section from your book, from the introduction, even before we get into the story, which we will talk about. But just, I think this kind of frames our discussion. And it's a beautiful section.
I owe this book to the young people of Camden, who gave me the honor of connection, who let me speak hope into their lives even as I sat at their feet to learn about my own. They, more than anything, any institution or any other person, have inspired, stretched, and trained me. The broken streets of Fillmore, 4th Street, Broadway, and Viola became my classrooms. I laughed and grieved with the 6th and Line boys, crossed over the hump, shared life with some of the brothers from the 8-Ball Posse and the sisterhood of the Gucci Rush Girls. On the north side, I was tutored in street navigation and survival by the likes of Big Ant, Buck, Bo, and Junebug. There, I also encountered my Latina justice queens, Taina, Christina, Chave, and my dear beloved Tuti, God rest her soul. Mm-hmm. Girls who took no shorts from anyone, insisting on fairness at every turn, leading with their street tough exteriors while masking gentle hearts filled with deep love. I have had the honor of fellowship among faces resistant to hardening, backs refusing to be bent, and bodies fully possessed by sudden explosions of joy, like the blaze of sunlight breaking through the storm clouds. My conversations with the corner boys, the hustlers, the ball players, and the ballers have been deeply moving, revealing levels of thought, creativity, and intelligence that rival any in the world. I carry them everywhere I go, both in miles and in thought. Their voices, their dreams, their laughter, and laments travel with me like a blessing, like a burden, like a calling that won't let me go. They are the pulse beneath the pages of this work.
Oh, thank you for reading that. Again, Tim Merrill reading from his new book, a novel called The Song Sparrow. I think of sparrows the way I think of squirrels, in that they're sort of everyday
Everywhere. Birds.
Yes. You know, they're not fancy looking, but they're there. They're
Yes. Survivors.
Why The Song Sparrow as a title?
Well, that's one of the reasons, is it's not an extraordinary bird.
No, they're everywhere.
and they're considered, you know, in the whole thing of birding, and I'm not a birder, but kind of a marginal bird. I find the greatest power out in the margins, the overlooked, the unsung. And here is this bird that becomes an icon of upward spiritual mobility, something that is that harkens back to the days of triumph through pain,
right,
and something that reconnects us to the spirit of that triumph in music and song and gathering and crying together and worshiping together and struggling together and raising fists together. And so that bird becomes that icon, not a phoenix.
No, not at all. No.
Not a mythical bird.
No.
But an everyday bird that lives out on the margins.
The book begins with Jabari. He's a musician and he's coming back to Camden. Tell us about Jabari.
Jabari is, I hope readers will see the subtext around Jabari of escape. He has reasons to escape the pain of losing a friend. And as you read that story of losing his friend is also my story. It's based on a true story of my friend who was brutally murdered by police.
Oh, man.
And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a businessman the other day, and he said, well, you got a fact wrong. And he's an insider. And he said, no, it wasn't 105 shots. It was 107 shots at an unarmed man. And so that pain drove Jabari out of Camden. And that's the subtext of the book. But he's compelled again by the experience of the black church.
Right.
He can't escape home. He's compelled by his mother's home and her spirituality and the spirituality of the black church and a cute girl as well.
So. I was going to say, and there's a cute girl in there as well. But he plays in a jazz band, I guess a kind of secular-ish jazz band, and also in a church band. So he's got these two sides of himself.
And that's one of the struggles historically in the black church is secular versus sacred. And I think we draw too strict a line between the two. But I hope the readers will see there's a moment here where the secular becomes so sacred that it brings Jabari to tears. And that's as he's playing a jazz number by a number that's brought me to tears, Herbie Hancock's Both Sides Now.
Oh, gosh.
Which is such a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
And it is sacred. And I think one of the things that the white Christian culture has taught us to do is to disregard things that don't align with their definition of sacred. And we've sacrificed a lot. And so you'll see, I hope the readers will see, that I regard jazz as our sacred music, music that belongs in sacred black space, reggae as music that belongs in sacred black space. I start quoting some hip hop from Black Star,
right.
And some hip hop belongs in that sacred black space. And those are sacred music as well.
Well, let's take a very short break, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Tim Merrill is our guest today on The Connection. He lives and works in Camden. He's a pastor there, working with young people, and has now become a novelist. And again, the book is called The Song Sparrow, A Novel of the Black Church. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Tim Merrill is our guest. He's a Camden pastor, youth worker, and we are talking about the power of faith and resistance and redemption, and his new book is titled The Song Sparrow. You mentioned Black Star, and you quote him in your book as well, Casualties of Abnormal Normality, the idea that what is truly abnormal becomes normalized, and then you begin to think that that's what's normal, right? You lose sight of what's abnormal and what's normal.
The people of our city have tremendous resilience and tolerance, and tolerance for things that are just abnormal. And one of the things I speak about is the conditions down Sixth and Ferry that are environmentally disastrous. We've had a series of fires at a recycling plant that have just billowed black smoke over neighborhoods, and neighborhoods have had to be evacuated. This is not normal. The stenches in that neighborhood, they are not normal. The pollutants that are resident there are not normal, but the people who are put again in this environment, and it's affordable. It's not normal, but affordable. They start to believe that this is the way life is. Mm. We had an incredible fight. Tell me where else this goes on. We had an incredible fight this fall because our school board president had sexual abuse litigation against him. And the litigation found him at fault and the school district at fault. And yet he comes to chair the school board meeting. The governor had called for him to step down. And he comes to chair the school board meeting as if everything were normal. And we had to protest and shut down the meeting and everything before he would finally step down. This is not normal. And so, unfortunately, if you oppress people so long that they begin to tolerate the oppression and they begin to think that it's normal. And we need to proclaim again and again and again, this is not normal and it should not exist.
In this novel, there's this surveillance system. You call it Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K, and it's basically tracking the residents there visually, but also through DNA. I mean, the idea that they can know everything about you. And I feel like we're kind of halfway there, all of us in this world that we live in with cameras and drones and, you know, facial recognition monitors, things like that. Are you sounding the alarm on where this is taking us?
I am. And I think we're seeing this happening with what's going on with ICE, the surveillance state, the oppression of people who try to broadcast the atrocity of what's going on. And it's all under the guise of public safety.
Right.
And Camden is a safer city today. And we have a lot of technology. I hear people in the street saying, you know, they need to stop all the shooting because there are cameras everywhere.
Right. There are cameras everywhere.
And the shot finder system, as soon as a gunshot goes off, they can pinpoint it.
Right.
But what are we sacrificing for our safety? And are there better ways? One of the things I was disturbed about is this summer, Camden had a murderless summer.
That's
For the first time in decades.
That's right.
But all the credit went to policing. And so if we put all our eggs in the policing basket, we are asking for this surveillance state where the true data suggests that it is the programs, the anti-violence programs, it's the community level interventions and things like that. But we're more and more putting all of our eggs into the policing basket. So we get community policing and barbecues and ice cream and things like that, which are great.
Right.
But also militarized police and an exorbitant policing budget that will be used to oppress people who are. So right now I offer my church a sanctuary to any immigrant that falls, you know, into trouble with ICE. But now that same policing mechanism under our current administration says they can come through the doors of my church and apprehend these people and apprehend me at the same time, because we're not honoring sanctuary as it's been traditionally honored. So we're building something in the name of public safety that's, I believe, ultimately will be our demise.
But that, you know, that's such a tricky thing to try to navigate. On the one hand, as you say, crime is down in Camden. What is the price? But you're also saying that we need to give the residents more, and perhaps the people like yourself, you know, more credit for tamping down some of this violence.
You know, we have heroic people that we partner with at our center, and they do things like teach martial arts and African dance and drum and things like that. These kids go to college. They don't go to prison.
Yeah.
So we should be investing in things like this because that's, you know, from a street level point of view, we see that that's what's making the turnaround, not the policing. And police respond to crime. These are the things that prevent it.
In your novel, there are two churches. One is the First Baptist Church of Camden, which is what kind of a mega church? I don't know. Is that what that is?
An aspiring mega church.
Aspiring mega church. And then one called Greater Deliverance Church.
Yes.
Which I feel like that's where your heart is, the Greater Deliverance. Yes?
Well, yes. It is the difference between a church that is centered on liberation. You know, I consider myself a liberation theologian. Mm-hmm. And so that church, and you see they're touching the streets, working with the unemployed, working with those who are trapped in criminality, working with those the women who have been battered and things like that, working with those kind of people. And the other is more for the people who kind of have fiend, you know, getting that they have their stuff together, you know. Now, I think we need to honor both churches.
Right.
And we need to speak to both churches so that they have the fullness of what we need in the Black community. There is a need for the Black megachurch.
There is a need for the Black.
There is a need because they have resources. They have congregations that are mainly middle class, and they have the economic buying power and things. Look what Jamal Bryan is doing in the boycott of Target,
right,
and the impact that it's having. So we need the megachurch, but we need the megachurch to be responsive to community needs. We need them to decentralize and get into neighborhoods and get out of their suburban enclaves and get in touch with people. But we need them. I don't want to throw them out because they're a valuable resource if they step up to their calling.
There's also a redemption theme in here. Can you flesh that out, why that's important?
Everyone, and I want to make sure that not only the street level people needed redemption, but pastors needed.
Yeah.
And politicians needed. And FBI agents needed. As much as they may struggle against it, they need it because people need second chances. And a lot of times we look at second chances as something for formerly incarcerated, yes, or the addicted, or the least last and lost. But no, we all need that second chance. We all have pains and issues that shape our lives that we need redemption from. And I wanted to illustrate that. And institutions need redemption. You know, the church needs redemption. And so I want to make sure that it was a broad spectrum analysis of what redemption can look like.
It feels, though, that we live in a time where it's so easy to not forgive people or to not let them redeem themselves. You've done one terrible thing when you're 22 years old, and that is you're marked for life.
Well, you know, there's a couple drug dealers in this book who I humanize,
yeah,
and show what redemption looks like in their lives. And that's important because we are quick, again, to demonize them and say they're the ones in need of redemption, where we don't look at ourselves and say, well, what is my role in it? What's my part in this? And we need to start looking at people as fully human. And I don't believe that we can see the full humanity of ourselves until we look at others with the view of full humanity.
The pastor, LB, in this novel says, talking about Moses, Moses's life is one of the most remarkable stories of redemption. A man who lived by the sword, who terrorized the land, was transformed not by his own strength, but by the strength of grace. He found peace where he least expected it, in the silence of the desert among men who chose God over everything else. That's quoting the minister, LB.
Well, yeah, St. Moses the Black or St. Moses the Egyptian is one of the early desert fathers,
yeah,
who was a criminal, who was a fierce criminal, and found redemption and became one of the great desert fathers that we don't talk enough about. And so he becomes an icon of redemption that applies not only to a drug dealer, but also to a pastor. And that's why it's such a prominent piece of right. this pastor, L.B. Haskins' world.
I mentioned Marduk, and I don't want to get ahead of the story, but you reference, you know, it's taken down, I'll just leave it like that, or the people rise up against it. But only one person was convicted for the creation and the implementation of Marduk, this surveillance system. And I feel like you're saying, and I think there are examples in our own country of a system that is allowed to flourish, and one lonely guy that worked in the back room or something is the fall guy for a system that has oppressed people.
You know, I look at the flooding of our neighborhoods with crack cocaine.
Yeah.
And this was something that came out of the whole Iran-Contra piece, and, you know, sending arms down to the Contras and bringing cocaine back. And who paid the price for that? The price was paid on our streets. The price was paid by countless of people who became addicted, and a prison industrial complex that was just put on steroids with the introduction of crack cocaine. And, you know, I watched Ali North at the hearings and others, and no one really paid for that except the people at the bottom. And that's too much a reality of how things work out in oppressive systems, is that when it comes to accounting, the people most responsible rarely are the people that bear the brunt of punishment or justice.
Do you believe in America?
I do believe in America.
Same.
My family's story is too incredible not to believe in America. You know, we're people that came from my father's side. Our oral tradition talks about those who escape from slavery and press for their freedom and build up from there. And my mother's side who came to these shores in the early 20th century and just built despite the segregation. My grandfather came here thinking he could be a lawyer. From a black man coming.
Where did he come from?
He came from the Bahamas.
Oh, from the Bahamas?
Yeah. And he went to Miami, in the heart of segregation and Jim Crow, and said, I heard America, I could be a lawyer. And he didn't. And he moved his family eventually to Philadelphia. The segregation, Jim Crow, became too unbearable, moved them to Philadelphia. And his children became all successful in their own right. And that's what America should be. Am I worried about the future of America? Yes, I am, because the Joseph Nottage story, Bahamas come and struggle and your children become success, should be everybody's story. It should be Lourdes and Julio's story from La Puebla, Mexico, and from Cuba, from Venezuela, wherever. It should be the story. Come to America and work hard and educate and rise up. I'm worried about the future of that story.
It's a kind of bootstrap story, but it also involves community, right?
It is the heart of the message of the Black Church, you know, the heart of our songs, you know, right down Avenue of the Arts, Broad Street, Tinley Temple. Well, Charles Tinley wrote, you know, when the storms of life are raging, stand by me. By and by, when the morning comes, we'll understand it. It's this whole thing of, yeah, I know it's a struggle, but we shall overcome. And that's at the heart of our spiritual message in our spiritual lexicon of Black America and all of America, because we all have similar stories that way of overcoming.
But it feels like we're so separated now. You know, we view each other with suspicion. We finger point. We say you're wrong, I'm right. How do we get past that?
We can if we go back to, you know, the connection. We are connecting with people and having those conversations, having those tough conversations. I have a Harvard colleague, and he's from India. And he really didn't understand all the racial conversation. And so we used to meet at the Painted Burrow in Cambridge. And all you could eat Mexican on Sunday.
Oh, my God. That sounds great.
And I said, look, brother, ask me anything. I won't be offended. Ask me anything. And we've had the most incredible conversations. And he's gained such an understanding of what the issues are. You know, he said, well, you know, back in India, we just said, get educated, you know, and all your problems are solved. And I said, hey, brother, have you ever heard of Brown versus Topeka? Let me talk about what education among African Americans has looked like. And so through those conversations that other people might find offensive, we have to have a prophetic imagination, as Berman says. And in that imagination, we imagine conversations that should be offensive, but our humanity and our thirst for common understanding should override the offense. And that's how we start connecting.
Yeah, but so often I hear what you're saying is we shut that down because either you're afraid to ask it or it feels offensive or somehow ignorant.
But if we
and then we get hung up on that.
If we love each other
do we?
We better start. I love all humanity, and if we love each other, we need to give permission for offense, as long as it's in the pursuit of love.
Oh.
Yeah. If it's in the pursuit of violence and oppression and domination, no. But if it's in the pursuit of love, if I need to understand you better, if I need to walk in your world, then I need to give some permission for offense.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Tim Merrill, as always, thank you for joining us.
Always my pleasure.
For conversation.
Thank you so much.
And again, you're very welcome. The book is called The Song Sparrow, A Novel of the Black Church. And again, Tim Merrill lives and works in Camden. He's a minister there, and he also works with young people. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen on the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find the show on Facebook. Also, check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Again, thanks for joining us.